You know, number one, I'd say is we try to keep the skill development individualistic, and it has to be relationship based. Like, I don't think I can teach really well unless I have trust with the athlete. And I've learned over the years that, you know, what I do say and what I don't say are equally important. So we try to get that relationship with our players before we ask them to make any type of change to the game. And it's something that humbled me then, and it continues to humble me every day, because I think coaches sometimes lose sight of how much players look up to them, and how much just like, hey, how you doing? Is there anything you talk about? Checking in on guys, like, that is something that goes a lot longer way than I think sometimes we realize.
You're dialed in to the ABCA's Calls from the Clubhouse podcast, connecting our coaches with some of the best baseball minds in our game. Now here's your host, Jeremy Schiedinger.
Broadcasting from the ABCA National Office here in Greensboro, North Carolina, welcome back or welcome to our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. This is your home for certified audio gold and your podcast destination where you come to learn and grow, connecting with tremendous baseball coaches. Pull up a bucket with us in the dugout. This is going to be a great conversation today. We are a community of lifelong learners where egos are checked at the door and there's always room for growth. We embrace the opportunity to challenge ourselves. That's why you chose to hit play on this one. Welcome to the show, guys. Connect with us on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at ABCA1945. Also, feel free to reach out to me directly on there at CoachSheets3 or by email Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. It's always valued, the tweets and the messages. The best part of this job is serving coaches and connecting with more baseball folks, hearing how these shows are hitting each and every one of you on the other end of the call. So please, always feel free to reach out. Don't forget to subscribe, review, and share, always with the reminders there. Hit that subscribe button on your phone, your computer, and your tablet. That way, every single Tuesday, you know our show will be right there waiting for you. Leave us a review on there so more folks can find us, and also share. It's one thing to take in a great show. It's another to jump the action gap and share it on social media or throw the link into a text group. Open up these shows to your players, guys. It's all about growing the game of baseball and challenging more people to find new ways to learn. So thanks for your help on that one. Speaking of challenging yourself to think outside the box, finding new ways to develop players, guys, those ideas bring us to this week's show and our guest. Jake McKinley, the head coach at William Jessup University, an NAIA school out in California, that at the time of the recording of this episode, they sit number 8 nationally in the NAIA polls, and they stand at 33-13. That obliterated the previous school record for wins at WJU of 10. Yeah, I said it, 10. And all that's inside of Jake's first season as the head coach of the Warriors. So inside this show, we let Jake open up his thoughts about constraints across all fundamentals, how this approach to training has opened many doors for his players and their growth inside the game, plus his unique perspective on building relationships with his players, building competition inside his program, and building programs in general. Jake is a special person, he's a special coach, and we're fortunate to have men like him inside our association and proud to be members. This is a take feverish notes episode, guys. I'm telling you, pen and paper are going to be needed for this one. A lot of dimes are about to be dropped, so let's go ahead and jump in and connect with William Jessup head coach Jake McKinley. He's our guest on this week's Dugout Chatter episode, and get ready, coaches, this great show is coming at you right now. Coaches, thanks for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast today. We are going the NAIA route, so I know my NAIA coaches around the country are going to be fired up for this one. We're going to connect with a guy that I think is one of the top young coaches out in college baseball. He's doing it on the West Coast, and the proof is in the pudding as to what he can do as a head coach. We're going to connect with William Jessup head coach Jake McKinley. Jake, thanks for jumping on the call with us.
Sheets, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm honored to connect with you, man. Again, we were laughing before we got recording. You and I met back in 2009. You're at Campbellsville. You guys are rolling. You go to the World Series that year. I'm at the University of Kentucky. We met, and if some stranger walked up and said, hey, in about 8 or 9 years, you guys are going to connect and do a podcast together. I would have laughed them out of the room. Number one, because I didn't know what a podcast was. But I don't know if you and I would have seen that one coming.
Yeah, I would have said that they were crazy too, because like you, I didn't even know what a podcast was. And I think the iPhone actually came out that year. So yep. I remember thinking that the iPhone concept was kind of ridiculous. Like, cause I had an iPod. I was like, why would I want to take phone calls off this thing that plays music? So there's no way I would have thought this would have happened about a decade later.
Well, if I'm reflecting correctly, at that time I was Team BlackBerry. And I would have signed a lifetime contract with BlackBerry at that point. yeah, this definitely wasn't going to come to fruition. But it is. It's really cool. And like I told you, I was laughing on the way to the office this morning. Really cool to connect with someone that I've known for a very long time and someone that we've connected and stayed in touch with, even when we were at Sac State and obviously watching what you did at Menlo and now at William Jessup. And I've even got this great email that you sent me about a year ago that really was heartfelt, but it was a really about your support, real kind words for what's going on here with the podcast. You want to open that up for our listeners?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it also just speaks to how I feel about the ABCA. Mm-hmm. I think it's the ABCA is the best learning resource that I've probably ever had, maybe other than my players or the coaches I work with every day.
Wow.
So I definitely am an avid podcast listener. And I went to my first ABCA in 2009, but I really, really got entrenched with it actually in 2015. We just finished our year at Menlo College. We won 33 games and that was a number that was like a good number in the community. Like everybody was pumped on it, but internally I was like, God, you know, I feel like we underachieved a little bit. So that summer I lived with Jason Ochart. He's the director of hitting up at Driveline now.
Sure.
We lived in Atherton, and Atherton's like the most expensive place to live on the planet. And so we had this like 400 square foot, one bed, one bath apartment, and you barely fit in this thing. And so we didn't have enough room for a TV. So we had a projector and we projected TV up on the wall above his bed, which was in the living room. So we started downloading ABCA convention videos.
Wow.
And we would airplay those onto Apple TV and then project it up onto the wall. Because after that season, it was kind of like, man, you know, what are we doing wrong? What do we have to do better? Mm-hmm. And I started watching all these conventions from the past years, you know, up on our trashy apartment wall. you know, it was just like every time we watch one, talk about it and things would get introduced that kind of blew your mind, but you're like, man, you know, if we implement that, it could really help. So, I really did discover that year just how important the ABCA is and how willing coaches are across the country to provide good information to help your programs get better. And
right.
The podcast is free. It's free. It's super easy to get on your phone. So, it's an amazing resource and, I'm super grateful that it's just right at our fingertips.
Love it. Well, what's really cool is, you know, obviously you guys are watching videos on your trashy apartment wall and, like the next year you hit like 6,000 home runs and you obviously brought that over with you to William Jessup, but I knew it wouldn't take long for an Ochart reference. I think I agree with you. I think he's one of the best young guys that's out there and I know he's listening to this and Jason, love you, man. Love what you guys are doing at Driveline and a guy I've worked a ton of camps with over the years and respect, immensely. Let's open this up because that leads us right into the front part of this talk. And I really want to open up, let our listeners start to understand where you're coming from. And so let's go into what are some of the strategies that you use to develop skills and enhance talent. I know you and I were talking about constraint-led approaches. Can you really open that up for our guys?
Yeah, for sure. And I can tell you that skill development is probably our number one sell in the recruiting process.
Okay.
So we've got to be able to speak that language, but I'd say it comes down to three factors, as we try to develop our players' talent. And don't get me wrong. I've had the fortune of working with talented players and coaches, my whole career.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, number one, I'd say is we try to keep the skill development individualistic and it has to be relationship based. Like I don't think I can teach really well unless I have trust with the athlete. And I've learned over the years that, you know, what I do say and what I don't say are equally important. So we try to get that relationship with our players before we ask them to make any type of change to the game. Mm-hmm. But once we do have that trust established, then yes, we try to implement constraints more so than queuing guys up. I mean, and there's a time and place for giving a guy a cue, but we try to put them in an environment where they can become their own best teacher.
Yeah.
And they can make changes maybe in their movement pattern or whatever that is they're trying to do or whatever goal they're trying to reach. So for an example, like I think this was the University of Iowa that introduced a drill called the Great Wall of Ground Ball Prevention.
Yes.
So you have the L screen, and then you have the screens kind of going to the baselines on either side of the L screen. And so a constraint, I would say the easiest way to describe it is just like you're placing something in the environment that places restrictions or limitations on the athlete. So, you know, if we had a guy that we thought his swing plane was a little too steep downhill, that would be a really good constraint drill. So as opposed to us saying like, hey, you know, you need to get on plane or, you know, your swing is too far downhill, we put these constraints in and it's just like, just try to clear these screens. And we trust that if we recruit good enough athletes, guys that are coordinated enough, their bodies are going to organize themselves to reach the goal.
Figure it out.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then we think that the learning is just a little bit deeper. It's a little bit more impactful, at that point. So we try to do that with almost, anything, as it could be, you know, a team drill. It could be an individual drill. We try to place in an environment where they're their own best teacher. They can develop their own feel so that when they are in the midst of competition, they're not like relying on a coach queuing them up. They've been placed in these environments where, you know, it does translate. And I think number three with skill development is, and this can be a constraint too, is competition. Mm-hmm. Competition, I would say, is just the cornerstone of our player development. So what we do in the fall, we actually, we select a leadership council after about 3 weeks, and they draft teams. So we give them a salary cap, and nice. We put a hypothetical salary on each player on the team. That'll involve his GPA, community service, performance on the field, and they have to draft this team. And if somebody goes over their salary cap, they have to negotiate a trade so they can both be under their cap. And then once we start practice, we actually have our team broken down into two. So for the first part of practice, it's your traditional style of practice, but we always finish practice with a competition. Wow. Where there is a winner and a loser. And then that competition extends past the field as well. Like we had a cook-off this year. We do a community service challenge. We do a field improvement challenge. And it places them in situations where like, I want them to experience the elation of winning, but also the devastation of losing and learning how to handle themselves regardless of what the result might be, you know, as a professional. Wow. And I think at the same time, too, you know, in those competitions, one of the constraints we like to put on our guys is like, let's say you're the team that's not on stage for whatever the drill is. Like we might give them a constraint like, hey, you have to be totally silent. So this team has to perform this task in total silence. And then we might green light them like, hey, you're actually allowed to talk trash. But if you're the team that's performing, you're not allowed to retaliate. So again, that's a constraint that we try to put on our guys. We want them to get a relationship with their nervousness. I think players get nervous during games and it's not a bad thing. I think you get nervous because you care and you want to do well. Mm-hmm. So we want practice to always simulate some type of pressure, some type of competition where they got to learn to win. Cause I do think that player development is learning how to win too. And I think sometimes we get into this mindset where it's just like about skill development, but I think learning how to win is a skill in and of itself. And if you're not simulating that in practice, you might be limiting your players a little bit.
Wow. Okay. There's a lot to unpack there. I'm trying to dive into this. Okay. So yeah. let's go with pillar number one, when we're talking about developing trust and developing the relationship with the players, which, you know, is a huge staple of this show and the mission behind it. So open that up. What exactly are you doing that's maybe unique to your staff and your teams that, you know, from the global perspective, from the 30,000 foot view above, would make sense to any listener? Like, oh yeah, we could easily do something like that, or we're doing something like that. What would you offer?
Yeah, that's a good question, because actually started doing something different probably for the last month.
Okay.
I downloaded an app on my phone called Out of the Hat.
Writing that
and,
down.
And so, yeah, Out of the Hat. It's super easy. Okay. And it's basically a digital form of like pulling a name out of a hat, right? So okay. I put each player on my team in this digital hat. And so every morning when I wake up, I'll draw two names out of the hat. And then I make a point of it that day to meet with that player and talk to him. And the crazy thing, my players don't know I'm doing this right now.
And
by the
now.
Time, by the time yeah, exactly. But I've tried to be discreet about it. So like, it's not like, hey, come to the office, I need to talk to you. You know, get an idea of what his class schedule looks like, and I'll shoot him a text like, hey, let's go grab coffee after your class. And then I just ask the guy, like, you know, how they're doing in their life, how the family's doing, for the guys that have girlfriends, you know, how's that going? Mm-hmm. How's baseball going? Academics, and you get to know them on more of a personal level that way. And that's an example, because I think as you go through the season, it's really easy to lose sight of that.
That's right.
As you go through the ups and downs and you naturally connect differently with different players on the team. So we try to like make an effort every day to get two guys to have like an in-depth real life man-to-man conversation with them. And I think it's gone a long way just as it relates to knowing about them, knowing about what makes them tick. You know, some guys need a pat on the butt and some guys, you know, need stern reminders when you need their behavior to be modified.
That's right.
But the more we get to know them, I think the more effectively we can coach them. And obviously, you know, I'm starting that in the spring. In the fall, I just think it's super intentional meetings with the players. We do entrance meetings. I know exit meetings are a very popular thing. We actually do entrance meetings.
That's cool.
So we bring them in and we just ask for them to share their goals as an individual, their goals, you know, for the team. Because then I think we can hold them accountable to it, and we can also help them, you know, reach those. So it's a lot of effort because we have a lot of guys, but I think, you know, investing that time into them individually helps us coach them more effectively.
That's outstanding. I wish I'd have done a lot more of that when I was coaching. That's a great idea, and I know there's a lot of coaches that are going to look for that app and really try to implement that. So appreciate you offering that, Jake. Go back to constraints. So we talked about the great wall of screens, which was such a great visual, and I've seen so many other programs adapt and adopt something like that to really accentuate the offensive side of it. So that's offensively speaking, but what constraints might you be doing defensively or even on the pitching mound? What would you offer our guys?
I can tell you like a team constraint drill that we do. We call it Slay the Dragon. Okay. And I'm the dragon, so I'll pitch against my guys from 55 feet. And we'll use some other guys to do that too, but.
And let's be straight. You were a pretty good pitcher.
It depends on who you ask.
Okay. All right. Matter of debate. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I was that guy that was 6'4" and everybody was like, gosh, why don't you throw harder? And I don't know. It's 86 and I got to make it work. but anyway, so like this drill, so from 55 feet and I'm throwing and I like to stay in good shape. So for the hitters, it is simulating. I'm trying not to pump my own tires, but I think it does simulate like a Friday style arm. There's velocity, there's movement.
Yep.
and then for the hitter, that's a constraint because we're limiting his distance from the pitcher.
That's right.
You know, it alters reaction time and a lot of other factors. And then for the defense, because I'm off the mound, the hitter is then obviously a little closer to first base. So the defense has to play faster. So again, like instead of us queuing up an infielder, like, hey, you need to have this movement pattern when you field a ground ball. It's more like, hey, I need you to get the ball to first base in 4 seconds. And however you do that, you do it, but it needs to be done. Mm-hmm. So that's one of our like team constraint drills that I believe gone a long way. One of the things we did with that actually a couple weeks ago, we only let our guys use one bat that day. And so we kind of simulated like, hey, we went on the road and we forgot the bat.
Yeah,
I hope that would never happen. But it was just like, yeah, it was like a 34-inch Louisville that I found in the clubhouse. And it's like, we're going to use it.
That's awesome.
I know some of you may not like it, but that's also a constraint.
Okay.
And I think with pitching, so, you know, we've all seen, just for example, like we've all seen that guy that he starts to throw his bullpen and it's like high arm side miss. And so I think when I was younger, like I would have been like, hey, you know, you're rushing and you know, your release point is off as a result, or, you know, cue something up, like try to stay close or try to stay back. So like one thing we'll do is, it's very elementary, but we'll just change the target. So, you know, for that guy that's a high arm side miss, like we'll literally just move the catcher over into the glove side batter's box and be like, all right, like you got to organize, your body's got to organize itself to get there. It's more of like a goal based task than it is a task.
Okay.
Like a task oriented deal. So we try to like change the target for the pitcher. One constraint that I actually saw, this was from Sac City, who's right down the road from us. They do a super job. One thing they introduced that I thought was awesome is, you know, pitchers, I think sometimes struggle to elevate the fastball. And it's such a good pitch. Mm-hmm. So they actually put like a parking, one of those like trifold things you would see in a parking lot to navigate traffic.
Yeah.
They just put it on home plate, or it was just in front of home plate. So they had to clear it like with their ball flight. And if they didn't, like, it would hit this thing, you know? And so like, you got the catcher back there and, you know, the pitcher doesn't want to hit the thing because it kind of screws things up for the catcher. You know, it's loud, it's embarrassing. they try to clear that. So again, that's just an example of, you know, placing something in the environment that provides limitations. And in turn, hopefully it deepens the learning for the athlete.
That's really good. Always love a good Derek Sullivan reference. Loyal ABC member.
Oh yeah.
Love Derek.
He's the man.
And definitely what he's doing at City. And let's go back to the third pillar. Let's talk about the competition. So you mentioned doing some things uniquely inside the end of practice. What are some other competitions you may throw out there at the end of practice to really keep that fresh? Because that's certainly a coaching point. I know I've talked about, I know a number of coaches talk about, man, we want to compete every day. Okay, well, great. What's William Jessup doing, Jake? What would you offer?
On the practice plan every day, on the bottom right corner, and I let these teams, you know, they name themselves, they design a logo. So on the bottom of the practice plan every day, it has their two logos and then their cumulative score throughout the fall. So we do a fall World Series, but it's more just like a three-game series at the end.
Okay.
The fall is like a season-long championship, so to speak. At the end of practice, like it'll show on the practice plan what we're going to do. So a couple things that we've done, and we try to keep it, at least when we're on the field, something that would happen in the game. So like, for example, we did pop-up priorities one time. So just instead of just, you know, banging the fungo, each team took 10 fly balls out of the machine, and the machine was shooting the ball like at ridiculous heights.
sure.
And then, yeah, and you know how that goes. Mm-hmm. Like guys do 720s and then the ball lands. But but one of the things that we did is we actually gave the team that wasn't on the field doing the pop-up, so the team that was like on deck, so to speak, we gave them an air horn. It was like, okay, you get two air horn blows. And so at any time, you know, the ball might be in the air and boom, the air horn sounds, and like the defense has to still figure it out and make the catch. But we've done competitions as it relates to like exit velocity. So like one team has, they'll set a lineup of five hitters and it's, you know, what team can reach 2,000 miles an hour fastest by their cumulative scores. That's been a good one.
Yeah.
Hitting placement, like situational hitting competitions, you get creative with it, but we try to simulate everything that's in a game. And we love to use the stopwatch, you know, for like team defense. You know, what team can execute, you know, this number of plays in under 4.2 seconds, something like that. So
wow.
we get creative with it, and we change it every day. But yeah, there's always a competition at the end of every practice, and we actually carry that into the spring a little bit. They're not on their fall teams anymore, but I mean, we did a competition the other day, and you know, it gets guys pretty fired up.
Sure, you know, it does. You had me at air horn. So I'm going to have to figure out how to remotely be an assistant coach at William Jessup so I can be part of this. That's outstanding. I appreciate you offering that. That was completely off script, but I think there was some audio gold in there that our loyal listeners would love to know about and hear from, and certainly add into their practice plans, what they're doing with their team. So Jake, thanks for offering that.
Yeah, for sure. We'll Skype you in.
There's no doubt. Every day.
You can blow the horn.
That's it.
Yeah.
Oh boy. I need a full-time gig. I need benefits and all of it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I want to tee this up for you because I'm a huge fan. I'm unapologetic. Usually every guy that comes on our show, I'm a fan of, but I really am of you and what you're doing, especially what you're building there at William Jessup. And I think what's really cool is you see it as a lot of people saw it, and I'm glad you have the opportunity to do it. You see that place as a sleeping giant and a place that could be really great inside of NAIA baseball. So I want to give you the platform here. Just talk about what's going on there at William Jessup, why you do feel like it is a great opportunity for someone to build a really powerful program. And more than that, what are you doing on the recruiting trails that's unique and different?
Yeah, sure. So William Jessup is in Rockland, California, which is East Sacramento. I thought it was a really unique opportunity because I think we have a lot of recruiting advantages. Rockland is one of the more affordable places in Northern California, but it's a super nice area nonetheless. The weather is fantastic. We have a brand new facility, and our facility is awesome. And then it's a diverse education. We are a Christian school, but we offer a lot of majors. We offer majors in the sciences, you know, which is kind of crazy. I can touch on this more, but at Menlo College, one thing I don't think a lot of people realize, we were about $60,000 a year, and there's only two majors there, business and psychology. So it was really, really narrow funnel to recruit.
Wow.
You know, at Jessup, and I'm not trying to compare places, but at Jessup, we have a lot that we can offer students, and it's affordable. It's a great education. California, the weather is incredible. It's just one of those places I thought, you know, with this brand new facility, and it's close to home for me too.
Yep.
It was a no brainer, and, you know, it's been awesome so far, but, you know, to speak about the recruiting process, I got the job June 1st, and we were very aggressive in the summer to recruit. But ultimately, you know, like anybody else, we try to bring in the best players that we possibly can to fit our program and fit the university. And we do so by, you know, we get out to local games, we get to the necessary showcases. But more than anything, I think recruiting has been successful because of leads that we get across the country. I feel like our coaching staff, we have an awesome coaching staff, and I feel like we're very well connected across the country. You know, for example, we have seven Hawaiian players on our team. We're well connected across the country. Our scout group in the area has been really, really good to us in terms of just giving us leads on players. But once we identify a guy that we want, you know, obviously we try to get him on campus and try to make him feel super comfortable. One area that I try to use as a separator is I really think that you take care of recruiting every day by just being really good to your players. And then I think your players become your best recruiting coordinators.
That's right.
So when they're on their visit, I like them to spend time with players without me there. And I'll joke with them like, hey man, go find out as much dirt on me as you possibly can. You know,
sure.
you need to know who you're going to go play for. So we like to get them with players. And one thing I always tell recruits, I will volunteer the contact information of any of my players, past or present, and some of our guys that are in professional baseball have really helped me, as it relates to recruits or experience. But you know, I try to be very transparent about how we operate, and you know, and I think the other sell that we have in recruiting is the skill development part. We speak very intentionally about how we try to make players better. I think that's why players choose a school, is because yes, there are aspects of the education. There's aspects of facilities and those factors that we all talk about in recruiting. But at the end of the day, I think we've got to be able to speak the language to the recruit. Like, if you come here, this is how we're going to make you a better baseball player and a better human being. And I think that has to be talked about. So I'll give you an example, Chief. Like, I'm going bald right now, and it's a crisis for me because I'm 33.
Embrace it, bro.
Yeah. It's rough every day. I'm like, gosh, it's a little thinner than it was yesterday. But, and so, like, you know, I've got some family and friends that are like, hey, you know, just like use Rogaine or use some hair product. I'm like, I'm not going to put these chemicals into my scalp. But if I was, I would want to see like before and after pictures, right?
Sure.
Like, show me a dude that's bald and then show me a dude with a full head of hair and I'll listen. But, so anyways, we try to use a lot of like before and after, like, you know, this player came here, under these circumstances and this is who he was when he left. So that before and after part is important to us in the recruiting process, as well, because I think we got to be able to tell a player like, yeah, you're going to get better here. And here's how we're going to go about doing it. But ultimately, you know, our best resources are our players in the recruiting process. And, I've been super blessed to have players that will go to bat for the program and go to bat for our coaches. And, you know, and I guess the last thing I'll say, at least at our level, I've found it to work. I'm a pretty low pressure recruiter. I tell the player, like, we would love to have you. We believe in our program. This is what we're going to do for you. But I'm not going to like text you and call you every day. I typically don't put a deadline on guys. I want them to want to be there.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, I think sometimes, especially a young person can be pressured into making a decision. I tell them, you know, go visit as many places as you can. This is one of the most important decisions you'll ever make in your life. So, you know, be sure you're informed and be sure that you're convicted in the decision. And so for us, I think it's helped us land a lot of players because I don't think players, you know, feel super pressured to commit. And it's more of a situation like, hey, I'd like to go there for these reasons. And if they don't choose us, that's the other thing. Like, we're never going to like blow up a player because he chooses another spot or, you know, get upset with them. We try to be very respectful of other programs. And if they make a decision that's not us, you know, no hard feelings. And I tell them that on the front end.
You know, that is a unique dynamic that's on this call. There's not a lot of hair that's on this call right now, which I think just adds an element that is hard to quantify. But mm-hmm. I'm really glad you get a chance to go into that and certainly excited what you guys are having off to a great season, setting school records at every turn. And obviously wish you the best of luck as we keep moving forward here. I want to go back to your early years because obviously you get done playing there at Bethany, you start coaching, you come to Campbellsville, you go back to Sac State. So, you know, those early years of coaching, what was motivating you then? What was your why to get into coaching? And then certainly, how are you still challenging that and growing each day?
Yeah. And it's evolved over the years for sure. when I played at Bethany, which is a small NAIA school, I actually had four coaches in 4 years. And I think at the time that was maybe viewed as a negative aspect, but I actually think it really helped me get into coaching because I think you model yourself after people you admire and people that you respect. And I liked all four of my coaches. So I think when I got into coaching, I wasn't a total extremist about things. Because I had seen that there's a lot of different ways to do it. But I played a little bit of independent ball after I graduated. So I played that first year after I graduated and I needed a job in the off season. And I got on as an assistant coach, but I more so did it because like, it was just an easy way to have resources to train. You know what I mean? But
sure,
I always was a player leader. So I felt like I could coach and I could help and I cared about the program a great deal. So, you know, that's honestly why I got into it. It was just a job for my first off season of independent ball. I still thought I had a chance to play in the big leagues. And so I remember it was like my second day on the job and, you know, I didn't really understand that there was office work that went into this. And I was in the office and I was like, there's so much work to do. I'm never going home. But as I went through that year, I really, really did fall in love with coaching and the impact you can have. So I went back and I played my second year of independent ball. And by the end of the year, I just was a run of the mill right-handed pitcher, and decided at that point I should probably look into a career. So I applied for coaching jobs like crazy, and I couldn't get any bites. Stayed diligent though, and through a mutual connection, Buford Sanders, the head coach at Campbellsville University, contacted me in December, and he actually had contacted my references before he contacted me. So I'll never forget it. It was December 18th, and we're on the phone, and we talked for about 10 minutes, and he's like, "Do you want the job?" And at that point, I'm like, "It's all I have, right?" And yeah. I'd never been further east than Utah,
right?
So I was like, I'm about to commit to moving to Kentucky in 2 weeks. And so I said, yeah, I said, I want the job. And he says, okay. He says, what size is your shoe? And I was like, I'm a 14. And then it's like silent on the other line for a couple seconds. And he's like, I beg your pardon. And I'm like, I'm a 14. And I think he said like, Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
How big my circus foot was. And so at that point I was like, okay, if this dude's going to buy me a pair of shoes, like I have to go. Like it's a done deal. We got the shoe deal.
Yep. Shoe deal's taken care of.
Yeah, exactly. So I packed up my Honda Accord and I drove out to Kentucky with my dad, and it was two of the best years of my life. I loved my experience there, and he was a tremendous guy to work for. And then I became a volunteer assistant at a junior college in Northern California, West Valley College, coached the pitchers, and then had an opportunity after 1 year to go to Sac State as the director of baseball operations. And when I was at Sac State, I was fortunate enough that every year a position above me opened up, and I was, you know, fortunate enough that Reggie Christensen promoted me to those next positions. Loved working for Reggie. He's the man. And then I got the Menlo. After a few years at Sac State, I got the Menlo College head job, was there for 4 years. That was an incredible experience. And then ended up here at William Jessup, which is close to home, which is nice.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's clamoring for the new LeBrons. I wonder if the McKinley 09s are out there, if we can find that shoe on eBay somewhere.
Yeah, you know, we were an Adidas program, and I remember specifically with their turf that the tongue of the shoe was like obnoxiously big.
And I think I know exactly what pair you're talking about.
Yeah. You put them on and you're like, okay, like who designed this thing? But yeah, I don't think that the McKinley 09s would be a hot ticket, to be honest with you.
Well, to accentuate how bad those shoes were, those turned into like my tarp pool shoes. Because it did. I wasn't going to wear those in public.
Yeah, no chance.
Open this up for us, man. I think this is a really cool question that I stole from another podcast that I thought was really neat in terms of what's something you learned recently, and certainly inside this season would be great, or maybe it was at practice, that really challenged your current thoughts. Maybe it was a situation, maybe it was a certain call, or maybe it was how you handled a situation that you really stepped back and went, you know what, I could be doing this differently and I could be doing it better. What's something you'd give our guys?
I have two responses to that, I'd say, because one of them I do hold pretty dear. So when I was at Menlo, and I know you asked for inside of the season, so I'll share that in a sec, right. But when I was at Menlo, our sports information director, he played on like a hardball team, like an adult hardball team. And he would always say like, hey, you know, do you want to come play with us? And I'd be like, no, like I'm not going to be that guy that like plays men's league in his 30s, you know? And so there was a Sunday though, we had a true off day. He's like, dude, we're short a player, like, please. So I went out and I played, and it was really fun. So kind of connected with the guys in the team, and I ended up being on like a men's league team for 3 years. But I'll tell you this, it might have been the single best thing I ever did for my own development as a coach. And the reason is like, I think when you coach, you can forget how much it sucks to fail as a player.
Yeah.
Because you know, you're connected to your team, you want to win, you want to do well. and you work hard to prepare, and then you just come up empty. Like that's a sucky feeling, you know? So, getting to experience that again, I think opened my eyes to some of that and helped me connect with my players better, and be wiser about what I said to our guys. So that's something that I did want to mention, because like, and I'm not saying like, hey, all you coaches go play men's league, it's going to change your life. But, you know, for me, like doing it, it really did open my eyes and see things from a player's perspective more so than maybe I had, especially when I became a head coach right away.
That's good.
I think I was maybe a little bit too harsh. And then I'd say this year, you know, one of the things that, you know, that I've learned a lot about is defensive positioning. Our assistant coach, Ty Mitchell, he's an animal, when it comes to advanced scouting, and he does a super job. And, I think that that's something that is a wise investment of time for coaches to look into, is where you're playing your defenders. And there's very, very readily available information as it relates to the percentage of ground balls hit, you know, where they go.
Yeah.
Just in general, in Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
And it's just really opened my eyes that, like, sometimes we see shifts on TV, and it's like, oh, my gosh, look what they're doing. They've got three infielders on that side. Or even the Astros, they had four guys in their outfield.
Yeah.
And it's not like a hocus-pocus, you know, let's roll the dice situation. I mean, there's great information that's readily available as to how you can most intelligently position your defense. So that's been a huge eye opener for me. And Ty's ability to put our defenders in the right position has without question been one of our biggest reasons we've had success, because guys hit into shifts, you know? So, I would advise coaches, don't demonize odd positioning of defense. In fact, like, look into it. It can make you better.
I'll add to that, Jay, because I had a great conversation at last year's Division II World Series and with Eric Newman, head coach at UC San Diego, and he has some professional baseball friends that offered the same type logic, and he attributed a lot of that last year's team's success to the fact that they went with what the percentages say, and so it's a little bit of shifting your shortstop over into the six, shifting your second baseman over behind the bag on righties on the pull sides, you know, switching that up for the lefties, and just kind of moving your corner guys accordingly. And it was really interesting because the other team hit a lot of ground balls into the six where I'm going, that's a hit. And their shortstop is literally standing there and fielding it straight up, not in a backhand play, but fielding it straight up and getting outs. And I'm like, man, that's interesting. What's that all about? He goes, man, we've done that all year. We've taken so many hits away. We've been in better positions to field what would be hits and taking them away just by really committing to defensive positioning. So I appreciate you offering that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing that I would say to that, because the reality is at times your defensive positioning is going to get beat.
Yeah.
You know, so like if you're going to play a pull side shift on a right-hander and, you know, he inside out to second base and that would have been an out, but it's now a hit. That how you respond to that as a coach is like super important.
That's right.
Because naturally, you know, people want to second guess it. Like, well, gosh, if we just didn't try it out, thank the game of baseball, you know, that's an out there. But again, yeah, when you play those percentages, you know, the percentages aren't 100 and it's going to get beat sometimes. So, and I've been just like what you described, there's been times this year that I'll see a line drive up the middle, and you've been around baseball so long, you see that the energy of the ball come off the bat, and immediately your mind says it's a single, and your second baseman's just like, he's just chilling behind the bag. You're like, oh, sweet.
Yeah, I'll take that out.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool. I think I know where this answer might go, but I'm excited to ask you, how do you define success? And then more than that, really discuss the shift that I'm certain that has taken place over the years in your coaching career.
Yeah, for sure. I think success is kind of situational. I think success, honestly, and this might be a little different than how others look at it, but I think success is shown in your results. You know, just the straight up mission accomplishment. Are you winning? Are you performing well? And I think sometimes in baseball, because, you know, focusing on the process is something that is very widely talked about right now. And I'm all in on it. But at the same time, I don't think we can lose sight of the fact that, like, we're measured by our results. Like, if you don't perform, you're not going to get paid as a baseball player, right? So we do attach the results to success, but our theory on it is, like, you're going to reach that success, or you're going to achieve those results through having a really, really good process. So, like, you know, there's a scoreboard for a reason. It shows a winner and a loser. It shows success and, you know, I guess proverbial failure. So how we measure it and how I try to measure it is, I guess, for two things is, number one, at the end of the day, can you look back on that day and know that you did everything in your power to be the best version of yourself in everything you did? And then number two, did you take care of your teammates? And I heard Eric Capitula say this at the convention, but, you know, we're on a lot of different teams in our life. Like, we're on a team with everything we do. And if you are keeping your teammates' best interest in mind with everything you do, you're probably never going to go wrong. So that's how we try to measure success. And then more of a compound effect with it. Like, let's just be really good today. Let's try to win the day today and stack those good days on top of each other. And I think that actually leads to the impactful change. And I'd heard this before, is that people oftentimes overestimate what they can get done in one day, but they underestimate what they can get done in one year. So we really, really do try to, let's just win one day at a time. And if we can look back and, you know, check both of those boxes at the end of the day, then, you know, that's success for us. And we're going to let the results take care of themselves. But I do think results measure your success, which I think sometimes is maybe getting lost a little bit today.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. That's really good.
Yeah.
Open this up, pull back the curtain on the Jake McKinley file, and let's dive into hidden talents and hobbies. What would you offer?
Yeah. I do have a really weird talent.
Can't wait.
Yeah. So when I was the ops guy at Sac State and I was the volunteer, obviously, you know, they're unpaid positions, and I lived right by a bowling alley. And so it was like cheap entertainment, and I started bowling, and I would go by myself, and, you know, I'd throw the little house balls, and I started getting kind of good at it. And then I started watching YouTube tutorials, and the next thing you know, like, I went and I bought my own bowling ball, and then I bought another bowling ball. Mm-hmm. And then I bought a bowling bag, bowling shoes. And then it became official when I got a wrist guard.
Oh boy.
So, I started bowling a lot, and I started to get pretty good. And then I started bowling in, you know, tournaments and leagues and, you know, bowling for money. And then I actually was at a point my last year at Sac State, cause I was 28, I was almost 29. And I had never been on a salary. Like, I'd never really been paid to coach. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, if I don't get a paid job in baseball soon, like, I might try to make this a deal for me.
I knew you were going there.
Yeah. you know, cause I was starting to, you know, bowl, I mean, very consistently over 200, but, you know, had a lot of games, almost 300, bowled several games in the 270s. And I was like, I think I could compete with these guys. I'm watching on TV with more practice. But then, you know, the recruiting position at Sac State came open, and that's obviously going to be more demanding in your time. And then I became a head coach, and I was like, all right, well, now I'm back down to bowling like once or twice a year. I'm just a ringer now, but yeah, it's a really weird talent, and I love it too. Cause every year I've got at least one or two players that they start talking a big game about bowling, and they'll be like, oh, you know, coach, I can destroy you. And I'm like, okay,
yeah,
let's go find out.
That's right. So Reggie Christensen just altered the universe by offering you a full-time position.
For sure. Golly. For sure. Yeah.
That's really cool. Again, staying on you personally, Jake, open up some daily habits or routines. I love the app, over Out of the Hat app. I think that reference is really cool. Something you do in the mornings, but just take us through maybe some daily habits, routines you have, and then also some resources, books, podcasts, things like that you're doing to constantly grow and learn.
For sure. Yeah, you know, and I think for a head coach, my personality is probably actually a little bit more on the type B side. I'm not the kind of guy that's like, hey, from this time to this time, I'm always going to be doing this. Mm-hmm. But the one consistency that I would say I have is every day I try to self-educate in some capacity. There's so many resources to do that. And I also like to be active. Like at practice, I love to throw BP. I love to hit a fungo. Love to participate with our players. But as it relates to the self-education part, I'm a huge fan of Audible. It's an app you can get on your phone, audible.com, and you can download audiobooks. I think we're on the move a lot. We're in the car a lot. And audiobooks are like an unbelievable resource. And they even have a feature now where you can speed up the narrator. And it's nice. Crazy. You know, you're talking about skill development, right? So when I listen to an audiobook now, I'm typically listening to it at, you know, 2 to 2.5 times the speed of the normal narration. So I'm just plow
speed reading, dude.
It's speed reading, but I'm just listening and soaking it in. And if something's said that I'm like, man, I gotta recircle on that. Yeah. I'll just screenshot my phone, and then go back to that later.
Wow.
Podcasts are super, super beneficial too. I usually, when I go to bed at night, that's usually what I do is I'll put on a podcast and fall asleep with the podcast. But, obviously this podcast is amazing. I'm a big fan of Top Coach. 1% Better with Joe Ferraro is awesome. And then I'll tell you two books that I think are imperative for coaches to read. One is The Talent Code. Mm-hmm. Just describes skill development. And I think that's a huge part of our jobs is, you know, we have to be able to work with players and provide them legitimate substance to make them better. But the other one is, there's a book called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and it's by Poe Bronson. I think it's the best book that I've ever read on competition. And, you know, the book starts off by giving an example of people that go skydiving versus people that do ballroom dancing, because skydiving is a solo activity. And so they took skydivers, the first time they ever go, you know, they jump and then they measured their arousal levels afterwards. And obviously they're super high, but by the fourth jump, they're kind of like over it, to be honest with you. I mean, you're free falling from an airplane at 13,000 feet and you're kind of over it by the fourth jump, which is crazy. I've gone skydiving before and I can't believe somebody would ever just get over it. But, but they measured the arousal levels of the ballroom dancers too, because they were in a competitive environment. And like the arousal levels never went down. So it's basically saying like, hey, competition is going to get people going more so than skydiving. And it's just because it's in our DNA to want to win. So the book really does a great job of painting examples between playing to win and playing not to lose, the difference between those and how you can avoid, you know, option B. Because I think we can fall into that trap a lot of that, like that mindset of playing not to lose, should always be playing to win. So great book for coaches, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing.
Wow. Okay. Now, Jake, I love this question and I'm excited to ask it. Is your most humbling moment in coaching? Because I know you're going to offer something really good. What would you offer?
Well, I've got my most humbling moment in coaching is actually, it's not a funny one, but I do have some funny stories for you too. But
perfect.
So this one's a little bit raw, actually. When I was at Menlo, I had a player my first and second year, and he was a good kid. He's a good player. And, his second year, I just started to notice, that he might not be doing so well in the fall. You know, his practice attendance was getting kind of spotty. His attendance in school was getting spotty. His appearance was becoming a little bit disheveled. So, you know, I called him in and we talked and I was just like, I think he needs help. And so I got, you know, our student life involved and his parents got involved and, you know, and we got him help, you know, professional help. But then, you know, our regular season started. So you start traveling and you go through all the aspects of a season and you get really busy. And so what I did is I stopped doing a good job of keeping in touch with him. I stopped doing a good job of reaching out to him and seeing how he was doing. And it was obvious that it was just because of this obsession with winning baseball games. And, you know, and I'll give you the short story, but this young man, he took his own life. And I think about him every day, and every time I go onto a baseball field, every time I'm at practice or a game, like, he comes into my mind. And it's something that humbled me then, and it continues to humble me every day, because I think coaches sometimes lose sight of how much players look up to them, and how much just like, hey, how you doing? Is there anything you talk about? Checking in on guys like that, that is something that goes a lot longer way than I think sometimes we realize. So it is a constant reminder, and it constantly humbles me out the field that, you know, players look up to coaches, and it's important. It's important to treat them well, and it's important to check in on them and make time for them. And I know how busy we all get, but, that's the most humbling thing that I've ever gone through. And, like I said, I think about him every day.
Wow. That's a powerful 3 minutes right there, dude. I really appreciate you offering that, because I think there's some coaches that are really going to, it's going to hit home on a lot of levels. Let's shift gears. Let's dial it back up. Let's go back to funniest stories. I know you got some gems that you want to share.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I've got one from when I was an assistant, one from when I was a head coach. So I'd say when I was an assistant, I took the Campbellsville job, and it was, everything happened so fast. I drove out to Kentucky, and one of the things that Buford told me before I went out there, he says, hey, be sure that you buy work boots before you get out here, because the weather's not as good as California. It's okay. So for Christmas, my parents got me a pair of Wolverine work boots, like light brown, and like these things went up to my ankles. And when I put them on, I'm like, I'm super thankful that they got them, but I'm like, I look ridiculous.
Sure.
So like the fourth day I was at Campbellsville, I get a call from him from Buford super early in the morning. He's like, hey, we had a septic leak at the field. I need you to come help me out. So I put on my Wolverines for the first time, and I've got these jeans on, and I go to the field, and he's like irritated at me. He's like, I thought I told you to wear work boots. I'm like, these are my work boots. He's like, those aren't work boots. Like, I specifically bought these to be work boots. He's like, no, he's like, those are the kind of shoes that you wear like out on a date. Oh. And I was like, Buford, you'll never see me wear these in public.
Yeah.
And
ever.
I promise you, if I am with a member of the opposite sex, I'm definitely not wearing these shoes.
Yeah.
He's like, well, I'm not going to let you wear those for field work. So we get in his car and we drive to Walmart, which is like right down the town, right on the other end of the town. And he brings me in and he shows me what he's going to buy me. And they're like those rubber boots that go up to your knees. He's like, yes, these are work boots. And I've still got my Wolverines on. Right. And so there's these two girls, and that's the thing about Buford. Like, he'll go talk to anybody. He goes up to these two girls. He's like, excuse me, ladies. He's like, I'd like you to meet Coach McKinley. And I'm like, I'm so uncomfortable at this point. I'm like crawling in my own skin. So I shake their hand. And he's like, girls, like, what do you think of Coach McKinley's shoes? And they're like, oh, we really like them. And so he tried to use that as a point, like, that the Wolverines were actually cool shoes. And then I proceeded to never wear them in 2 years. And actually, when I left Campbellsville, the last thing I did before I drove out, because I left late at night, I went into his office and I put the Wolverines on his desk, and he still has them to this day.
That's
his memento. But I'd say as a head coach, because, you know, sometimes we get so entrenched in what we got going on, and, mm-hmm. and I think players love head coaches that have a sense of humor, which I try to have. But my first year at Menlo, I was 29 years old, so I was still, you know, I was a pretty young head coach. We took our team up to British Columbia to play UBC, and we lost 3 out of 4. We were actually happy to get a game. They were a really, really good team. But after the series was over, we took the team to dinner, and so I wore jeans and a hoodie, and my hoodie was made by Vulcan, which I guess is like a brand for surfing, which, yeah, skateboarders, surfing. Yeah, and I guess there's an age cutoff, you know, like you can't wear it after a certain point, at least with my players thought. So, like, walking to dinner, and this freshman left-handed pitcher, he's like, hey, he's like, sweet Vulcan, bro. Like, what? And so my team just starts, like, kind of giving me hell for wearing a Vulcan hoodie because, like, they thought I was too old to be wearing it. So the next morning, we had to leave for the airport at 3 a.m., and this pitcher that got this whole thing of, like, let's make fun of Jake's clothes together, whoever started that, his backpack was by the van, and I saw his passport because we're in Canada, so I saw his passport, and I'm like, oh, perfect. Like, I'm going to swipe it. And, you know, like, give him a lot of anxiety as we go to Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. The problem was, we're approaching Border Patrol. I realized he wasn't in my van. He was in another van, and I had his passport. Boy. And, like, and so, yeah, we're approaching Border Patrol, and, like, I don't think the players in my van knew. And so I got to, like, tell this Border Patrol guy, like, hey, I'm a college baseball coach. And, you know, as a joke, I stole one of my players' passports. He's in the van behind me. And this was a guy that, like, had no interest in funny business whatsoever.
None.
But he ended up being, like, pretty cool about it. And I wanted to call him and be like, hey, I have your passport, but we're in Canada, so, like, the phones aren't working, right? So that was another one. Like, we laughed about it today, but I was like, oh, man, this is super terrifying. Like, I got to tell Border Patrol that I stole a passport. I think that's a felony.
I could serve jail time for this. But, yeah. Man, what a great story.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Still laugh about to this day.
Oh, love it. Staple this show, Jake. We always talk about the personal Mount Rushmore. I've gotten some terrific answers over the years, and it's a great way to throw some shout outs to some guys that have been influential on you throughout your career. Who's on your personal Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, that's four guys. Number one is a guy named Chris Lewis. He's the head baseball coach at Dawson Community College in Montana. He was the first ever head coach that I worked for at Bethany, and it was just two of us. So he really, really showed me what it means to be a good worker. And he entrusted me quite a bit for a first year coach. And he continues to be the guy that I go to, when I need advice, when I need to pick someone's brain, whether that's baseball or non-baseball. Two would be Buford Sanders at Campbellsville, you know, just giving me the opportunity to expand, my life and my network by giving me that opportunity in Kentucky. He made a huge impact on me, as a baseball guy and just as a man. He's an unbelievable person, and he's a great coach. And, he's made a huge impact. Number three would be Reggie Christensen at Sac State. Reggie's made a huge impact on me as well. He was the guy that gave me a chance to, you know, get to the Division I level. It treated me super well, probably gave me more trust than I deserved. You know, he continues to be one of my mentors and somebody I go to when I need things as well. And then number four actually would be my dad. My dad coached me until I was 14 years old. And my dad is he's the nicest guy in the world. And so just as it relates to how to treat people, how to handle yourself in any situation, my dad was just a great role model. And he coached me, you know, like I said, until I was 14. So his impact is obviously lifelong.
That's outstanding. Going to this, I love this question. We talk about the ability to describe the qualities of the best players, the best teammates, people that you've been around in baseball. What seems to rise to the top when you think about that question?
So being a good teammate is something that we talk about pretty much daily here. And the way that we describe it is a good teammate does their job exceptionally well, but they're not limited to just their job description. So painting a picture, like just being a human being, if you're walking down the road and you see a piece of trash, it's not your job to pick it up. It's not in your job description, but if you're a good teammate to society, you'll pick up the trash and throw it away. And I say to our guys, like, you know, we have field job responsibilities, and you know, if you're walking outside the stadium and you see a baseball, like was it in your scholarship agreement that you have to pick up a baseball? No, but if you're a good teammate, you know, you'll do it. So like I said earlier, you are on a lot of different teams in your life, and I think it's in our nature to want to be on teams with good people and people that better situations and people that provide good energy. And I think that's what I look for in a teammate. And I think that's consistent across the board. The best teammate I ever played with, Daniel Mava. And I obviously his story is just remarkable in and of itself, but, you know, that's how he was. He was just like always willing to do anything for his team. And he was an elite player as well. But, you know, it's just those guys that provide energy, and make situations better just because they're in them.
Oh, that has got some power to it. Take us home on this, Jake, man. I love this question. We talk about the best advice you've ever been given, but then what else, man, just from where you sit, what else would you offer any coach paying attention to this show?
Absolutely. You know, I got two bits of advice when I was a young coach. Number one is, you know, we all want to move forward in our careers and in our profession. But the best way to do that is just to be really good where you're at now. You know, I think we all have lofty aspirations. Sometimes we can get outside of the present where we're at. So like, do I have goals outside of where I'm at now? Well, sure. I want to advance as far as my abilities will let me in the game. But the only way I can do that is to be the best coach I can be at William Jessup University. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, I was a volunteer pitching coach at a junior college. Like I had to be a good pitching coach in that moment. So that's good advice that I got. Just be really good where you're at and opportunities will present themselves. And the other advice that I got, which actually took me a long time to put into application, is to be yourself. I think you kind of enamor leaders when you're young, and you try to model yourself after them. And one of the knocks on me when I was younger is like, you're never going to be a head coach because like you're too nice. And so like in turn, I tried to flip the script, and then I kind of became a jerk, which is like, A, that's fake. And B, like it doesn't give you fulfillment. Be yourself. And if you work hard for your players, and you do it organically and you're true to yourself, then I think there's a lot of different ways to do it. And there's a lot of different ways to connect with people and coach people. Don't try to be something that you're not. But the best advice I could give to a young coach is just be kind to everyone. I can honestly say that every form of advancement I've ever had professionally or in the game was because somebody had to vouch for me. Mm-hmm. And it's not always going to be the people on your reference sheet. You never know who you might need to vouch for you. It could be somebody you played with, somebody you coached with, or somebody that's not even in baseball. And the truth is, like, the only reason I was able to get a job in Division I baseball is because my independent ball GM, and she was the only GM in the country who was female, she ended up getting an assistant athletic director job at Sac State, and she's the one that went to bat for me with Reggie. And I remember when she got the GM job, it was just different. You know, we had a female GM, but I had a great relationship with her, and she helped me out. And I, you know, at the time, I don't think I thought like she was going to help me get a coaching job one day, but it ended up happening. And I also think, you know, we're human. We make mistakes, and sometimes, you know, in the downs of things, we'll cross the line of that kindness. Then I think it's really, really important to be man enough to apologize and say, I'm sorry. I think people appreciate that. But I just think like kindness is always the right approach. And if you keep that as a priority, it's going to serve you well. And I can tell you, like, if I was ever going to hire an assistant coach and a mutual connection said like, hey, he's a great baseball guy, but he's a jerk, there's no way I would hire him.
Right.
I want to be around people that energize our players and our recruits. And I want to be around people that, you know, I enjoy. So that's the best bit of advice I'd have. And like I said, we're not going to be perfect, but if you try to be kind to everyone, I don't think you'll ever go wrong.
And that sums up exactly why we want to bring you on the show. And more than that, we're proud to have men like you inside the ABCA and representing our association, Jake. And again, like I mentioned earlier, man, we wish all the best of luck to you guys as you continue to do great things there at William Jessup throughout the rest of the season moving forward. Thanks for jumping on our show, my man. We appreciate connecting with you, and we look forward to catching up again with you soon.
Yeah, Chief, thanks so much for having me, man. This is awesome, and I'm a huge fan of your show, and just keep up the great work.
Thanks so much for dialing into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast and checking out another one of our Dugout Chatter episodes. Now, here at the American Baseball Coaches Association, we are here to serve coaches around the world, so let us know how we can help. Head over to our website, abca.org, for more information. Make sure you're following us on Twitter, at ABCA1945. You can also find us on Facebook as well. And feel free to reach out to me directly on Twitter, at CoachSheets3, or by email at Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, at ABCA.org. We'd love to hear from our loyal members and continue to find ways to keep growing this game together. As always, coaches, thank you for listening in and staying dialed into our Calls from the Clubhouse podcast. Until next week, coaches, keep growing, keep developing, keep challenging yourself inside this game. We wish you and your club the very best, and thank you for what you're doing for the game of baseball.